The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
Hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show. My name is Chris Stein. I'm a certified financial planner and a finance instructor at Colorado State University. And this is the January 30th, 2016 version of the Retirement and IRA Show. I'm joined today in studio currently with Peter Scott, our estate planning attorney.
Yes. Good afternoon, good morning, and good day.
Exactly. This is a that's our typical greeting on a pre-recorded show. So this is a what we call a live recorded show. We do it live, as in one take, unless there's some egregious error. But we really haven't had to redo anything. Cross your fingers and knock on wood, I guess. Might have doomed us for this particular show. But Pete and I are here right now. Jim had an overlapping engagement with a hairstylist of some type.
Yes, he's having his hair done, as I understand.
I believe that's what's happening. All I know is the appointment was with a hairstylist. I would assume it involves his hair, which he's very proud of, and still has quite a lot of hair. I have noticed that I'm not sure he has that he's graying a little bit on the sides, which he's always been very proud of. A lack of gray hair to this point in his life, since he is over 50. And
Well, he can be distinguished now.
He hasn't been able to have the distinguished label applied yet. So we'll see if when he comes back, if it's missing, we'll know that there was more than just hair cutting going
on. That's right. So he will be distinctive in training.
So we'll give everybody a report. He doesn't know we're talking about this. We'll give everybody a report. Maybe just I'll whisper it to everyone when he comes back.
Yeah.
If there's gray or no gray,
that'll be
the code. I'll whisper it so he doesn't hear what we're talking about.
I'm sure he won't notice.
Right. Last week we had a live show, answered a few callers' questions. We're more than happy to do that at any time, whether it's a live show or if you contact us during the week when we're not having a live show. Right now you cannot call into the studio if you're listening on the radio or streaming it live, as it's broadcast on January 30th, 2016. It's broadcast from 8 to 10 a.m. on Saturday mornings. That's our local time here in Colorado. We are actually recording this on, what is today, the 26th, I believe? Yes, Tuesday the 26th in the afternoon at 1:53. It's a beautiful blue sky day, but a little chilly outside still. But
a little cold, but getting warmer
in the next
few days.
Luckily for us. So I think, Pete, you had, I told people they could get a hold of us. Best way to do that is jimhelps.com. That's the website. You can see the team there. You can see everyone who you hear on the radio, plus some of the people who work in the office here, as well as contact us. So if you have a question that you'd like answered directly, or maybe pose a question that you might think is helpful to other listeners so we can answer it on the radio, just go to jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And you can fill in the simple contact form there, and we will get back to you and might use your question anonymously, of course. We won't divulge any of your personal information. We usually change things up just a little bit to make absolutely sure no one can be identified. But we'll answer that question for you. We're always happy to hear from people.
Indeed.
As we are today. Yes. I believe, Pete, you've gotten a couple of questions regarding your area of expertise, the estate planning realm, and what do you have to share with us today?
Well, this came in, I guess a couple of weeks ago, and we just haven't had a chance to get to it, but it was an email, and I'm going to paraphrase it just to make it a little shorter, succinct, and to perhaps cloak some of the identity. But basically, we had one of our listeners email us that they were doing some estate planning, and they described their family a bit. And one, at least the, as it pertains to the question, was that I have two children, one of whom is very responsible and disciplined and sort of a self-starter, and the other who is irresponsible and not very dependable nor good with money. I'd like to treat my kids equally, but I'm concerned about my one child who is irresponsible and concerned that anything I leave that child would be dissipated inappropriately, and they were concerned about that. So the question really is, how can I treat them equally and yet protect the one child perhaps from themselves? They didn't quite phrase it that way, but that's generally what we're dealing with. And that's not uncommon. I find that very many, many families who have multiple children will have one or more children who are perhaps not as responsible as the parents would like. That could be to age, maturity, any number of things, although I did have one lady whose 50-year-old was still irresponsible. And so, but the solution to that is pretty much the same. They all vary a bit depending on what the parents want to do. But I am a big opponent of leaving anything outright to anyone. Not because we don't trust them, it's just because of all the things we can do to protect their inheritance from being taken from them. So what I would suggest to this person is that we use trust for the kids, including the responsible child. The responsible child may be very dependable, reliable, et cetera, but the world in which they live is not quite as kind and thoughtful, and the responsible child could end up in a divorce, could end up in a lawsuit because of a business failure, an auto accident, any sort of sorts of things that could expose them to personal liability where they would lose or have the chance of losing all that they've accumulated, including any inheritance that they would receive from their parents. And so that trust is pretty straightforward in that basically what we do is put it into a trust for that child. The convention that I've seen and is somewhat traditional is to provide that it goes into trust for a child, and they distribute a third at 25. When the child turns to age 30, they distribute to them half of the remaining balance, and then at 35 they get the rest of it.
Now, I've heard in the past that you aren't a big fan of that approach.
I'm not, and the reason is because every time you make one of those distributions, you're putting those funds or that inheritance into their hands, and it is now exposed to their creditors.
And you're essentially you're trying to think ahead, look into the future, and predetermine that those are appropriate times in the future to distribute when you have absolutely no idea what's going to be going on in that child's life at that time. So I would tend to agree with you that having that kind of fixed schedule without knowing the future, which none of us do, seems a little bit risky.
It would make planning a lot easier if we could sort of crystal ball into the future.
Exactly.
But so far, no one's invented that I'm aware of. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, and that's the issue, really. Those are arbitrary dates, and the child could be going through a very nasty divorce. They could have some sort of addiction, drugs, gambling, what have you, that would create a problem for themselves. And so I like leaving it in trust for them. Even if the child is responsible, you can put the child in control of the trust with adequate protections that they could access it for anything that they need. And if they needed it at all, that would be fine in those cases. But no one else could take the money from the child. It's strictly for that child and that child alone.
Now, clearly, that version of a trust with that kind of language would not be appropriate for the spendthrift.
Correct.
Having when you said if they needed it all, that would be fine. That's kind of one. This particular emailer was concerned with one child having that sort of access.
And that was their focus primarily, but I kind of went down that other trail just to explain the trusts are also for responsible children, and you can give them full use and control of the trust, that is the responsible child. But the fact is they don't own the property, the trust does, and as a consequence, you can't take something from them that they don't own. And so that's basic theory behind that.
Right. And I really like, as a side effect, kind of the approach you're taking so far, where you're proposing a trust for both of them, that at least that kind of levels the playing field, which a lot of parents are concerned, that not only are they truly fair to the kids, each individually, but also have the appearance of being fair as well.
Yes.
And even though there is a distinction between the two, one being a responsible, one being a spendthrift, where you could totally justify treating them differently in my mind. That's a totally valid concern the parents have, at least by saying, well, we're not just putting locking the money in a trust for one, but just handing the keys over on the other one. You're kind of putting them both. You're proposing put them both, both of their inheritances into trusts.
And that feels like it's more equal.
Yes.
You've got equal amounts,
so too. Yeah.
Both in trust. It's just the terms of the trust may vary.
Yeah.
Now, for the other child, who we may affectionately refer to as Flaky John, which is, tends to be the name we use in our planning for examples.
Flaky John.
Flaky John, okay. And, you know, the Penelope Perfect is the
is the
good child. Uh-huh. So, but anyway, Flaky John, not having the level of maturity, or because of problems of that linger as a result of poor decisions earlier in Flaky John's life, the parents would put it into a different kind of trust, and that would be one where John may not have the full use and control, and typically would not. That would be placed, that those decisions or control would be placed in the hands of a trustee that is other than John. It would be some independent person. It could be a relative. It could be an uncle, an aunt. It could be a family member. It could be someone totally independent, or even a professional trustee if the amount in the trust would justify that additional expense.
Now, my immediate reaction, I'd be a little nervous myself having another family member be the trustee. Certainly there's advantages, the trust that you might have with it being a family member, but then you're kind of setting up, you'll be gone. The parents, of course, well, these trusts are going to be in effect once they've passed away. But you might be leaving a big family fight behind where there's a lot of resentment that, okay, you know, Aunt Sue or whoever, who's the trustee, won't let me have my money. And that causes a lot of hard feelings and that sort of thing. So do you recommend avoiding that, or is that, or do you see that as a problem regularly?
Well, yes, it always is, because when you put some other family member in charge of a person's money, that is really courting disaster or destroying any relationship that they might have. Although there are some of our clients who that is very appealing to them, not because of destroying the relationship, but because that uncle or that aunt is particularly disciplined and holds a hard line, and that's been the relationship they've had with that child. So that's who they want there. And it really becomes a matter of the family dynamics. But if you want that child and that family trustee to have a loving, kind relationship, it's going to pose some challenges to that by putting that relative in charge of that child's money. There are professional trustees, individuals out there. There are certainly corporate trustees that are available. They do have various thresholds in terms of what size trust that they will manage. Sometimes as low as, depending on the organization, could be $200,000-$300,000 in the trust to make it worthwhile in terms of their fees and affordable. Many of the larger trust companies have $1 million to $5 million threshold, which leaves most of us mere mortals out of that mix. But it's worth talking to them. They have the smaller banks/trust companies usually have a lower threshold, only because that's really their client base and who they're catering to. But having a professional trustee involved is always a good thing. You can also have a professional trustee and a co-trustee that could be a family member, but it would take the unanimous consent of both trustees for any distribution. Oh, so
that's an interesting solution to what I was thinking in the back of my mind, not to talk out of both sides of my mouth or face or whatever the phrase is. We need Jim here The advantage, of course, of having a professional trustee is you wouldn't have the family dynamic. But then if you're having some of the decisions that are somewhat subjective about is this a justifiable reason to distribute funds to the child, how do they make that? It would be fine if you could list all the possible reasons, and it's a nice, they just say, okay, is this reason on this list? Okay, you get money. It's not on the list, you don't. Things don't usually work that cleanly. There's got to be some subjective measures or decisions made. I would probably tend to trust a family member to make those type, because they know the family dynamic, they know the history, they know all that kind of stuff. So there's kind of a advantages and disadvantages to both of these, the family member versus the professional. But I like your idea of kind of the team approach, where the professional might certainly take input from the family member trustee, but it takes a joint agreement, a unanimous approval, really, to actually distribute funds.
That's not uncommon either. That's a technique that's been used at least over the decades of my career, where you have the family member who's really kind of the boots on the ground, assessing the personal needs, the relationship, the veracity of the beneficiary and requesting various distributions for things. For example, if the last time the beneficiary decided to go to college or to a trade school, they signed up, the trust paid the tuition, and then they went in and withdrew and got the money, a family member would probably have some inkling of that and would suggest, no, we're not going to go that path again, sorts of things. I mean, there's all kinds of tricks. Professional trustees will be aware of that. But it's going to be a lot easier for the family member to do that investigation than the corporate trustee who has professionals that are charging for their time and effort, and so it can get a little expensive on that. So that's a good compromise between the two, but that would get us to the trustee. And then the terms of the trust would be different than it would be for Penelope, the perfect child. Johns could say that the distributions are generally the phrases health, education, and maintenance. That comes out of the Internal Revenue Code. It's a term that you'll see quite often in these trusts. That doesn't give the trustees a whole lot of guidance. So that you could put in other types of provisions. I've set them up where the distributions are to the child would be equal to their earned income as reported on the federal tax return. So that if the child, now this is up to the parents as to what they would want, and that's a topic of discussion because that's part of the planning process to explore those possibilities. But if that's what they want, if they're concerned about their child just becoming what we call a trust fund baby and that they're just going to live off the trust and not be a productive contributing member to society, they may say, well, you know, we'll match the earned income, or we'll match it in some way, not necessarily dollar for dollar or in some manner. And it would be, we don't want them getting these jobs where they're paid under the table, the non-reportable taxable income, which happens sometimes. We see that with younger kids, and especially in the construction industry. Where that might be an arrangement that they've set up. But it would have to be reported on their federal tax return. That could be verified by the trustee. They would get that distribution. If they chose not to work, then they don't get any distributions at all. The other is there could be incentives. That is, if you have a child who you want to encourage them to maybe be a stay-at-home parent. So the trust could be described in a way that we want to encourage them to do that. Distributions would be possible to support a child who would be staying home to raise children and that they wouldn't be penalized or be forced to go to work to provide for their family. And so you can have those. You can have educational incentives. If they graduate from college, trade school, what have you, that there would be a distribution of $5,000, $10,000, whatever would be appropriate, those sorts of encouragements. So there's a lot we can do with that trust in addition to just strictly protection. And the other part of that is because the money is owned by the trust, as we mentioned with Penelope, with John, Chris, you had mentioned the term spendthrift, which is a provision within the trust that says that the beneficiary cannot pledge or encumber their prospective trust distributions. They could try, but the creditor would not have the ability to attach any of those distributions until they were actually in the hands of John. And nor could a creditor come in and say John had an accident, he was sued, there was a judgment against him. The creditor couldn't come in and say, okay, next distribution out of this trust we get. The trust prohibits that, and as a consequence, that's not available. They have to wait until it actually hits John's bank account, which raises a different point is a lot of times, in fact, I'd say almost all the time with trusts, that we authorize distributions to John or for his benefit. So if John does have a judgment out there that the creditor is trying to grab hold of, then the distributions for John's benefit would be, say, to pay his credit card bill, to pay his tuition directly, where John doesn't really receive the money directly, and as a consequence, the creditor is not going to be able to grab it because John never had possession of it.
Mm-hmm. So they could pay, the trust could pay bills of John's, really anything, rent, electric, utilities bill, any of that, as long as it goes directly to that vendor or landlord or whoever it might be, it bypasses the creditor's fingers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
In that. So that's an interesting
addition. That's the way we write most of them. Even with Penelope, the perfect child, we would do the same thing to her or for her benefit. And it gives us the flexibility to do that. Penelope may be perfect, but maybe her marriage isn't. So even the good child with the divorce rates for first marriages hovering around 50% or more, she's got about a 50-50 chance. And so if it does end in divorce, then those funds are protected. Also, if Penelope or John end up getting married and they don't obtain a prenuptial agreement where the new spouse or prospective spouse would waive any claims they might have as a spouse, the assets that they have accumulated or earned during the marriage would be subject to division by the divorce court, but the trust would not. And just for clarification, in addition to divorce, in every state with the exception of Louisiana, you cannot disinherit a spouse. So that if they were separated and, say, Penelope died, then her spouse could claim, even though they were separated but not divorced, that the spouse could claim a portion of her estate regardless of what her will or trust may have said if she had done any planning. Mm-hmm. And in Colorado, which is not dissimilar to other states, he would be entitled to 5% of her estate for every full year of marriage up to a maximum of 50%. So her soon-to-be ex-spouse at that point could claim up to 50% of her estate at her death, and that would include inherited funds and gifts, whereas with divorce, inherited funds and gifts are considered separate property and not subject to division in the divorce court. At death, it's entirely different. They take a look at everything and apply up to the 50% there. That, of course, can be all waived in a prenuptial agreement, but the trust then protects it even if there's no prenuptial agreement that's been signed in advance of the marriage.
Perfect. So once again, through these examples, hopefully people see that trusts are the mechanism for you to exert control over your assets once you pass away. There's certain trusts that are used while you're still living, and that provides you certain benefits. But what we're describing here is once the parents who accumulated these assets have passed, they still essentially have predefined what happens to those assets. They haven't just given them up and let them float in the wind and hope it all turns out for the best, which too often these days things don't when you take that approach.
Exactly.
So that's why we have this That's why we have recommendations like you just gave.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So, yeah. So I think that is a fairly common situation where people are worried about what their kids are going to do with an inheritance. And the inheritance doesn't have to be huge to justify doing this. So keep that in mind. If it's a few hundred dollars, we probably don't need to be having a discussion. But even when you get into several thousands of dollars or just a few tens of thousands of dollars, that's when you need to start thinking about what's going to happen. So this is the end of the first segment of the Retirement and IRA Show. As we head into this break, when we come back from this break, we're going to hear one of the top songs from 1935, which is the year that Social Security started. The hint on this song originally flopped but was rewritten for the 1935 film Roberta, starring Randolph Scott, Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers, and Irene Dunne. So we'll take a listen to a top hit from 1935 that was originally a flop. This is the Retirement and IRA Show. Thanks for joining us. We will be back with you right after the short break.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, madam, with you. My heart won't let my feet do things they should.
Well, welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is one of the top songs from 1935, the year that Social Security started. As we kind of look back at some of the aspects of Social Security on this radio show and kind of tie it into the music that we play. That, of course, very recognizable voice, right, Pete?
Yep.
Who was that, Pete?
That would be, Dance Fred Astaire.
That was Fred Astaire.
It wasn't Ginger Rogers.
It was not. No. Jim, would you like to take a guess as to the title of that song?
No. No.
I won't dance.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
I would have never got that.
Well, Jim didn't, for sure. So welcome back. This is the second segment of the Retirement and IRA Show for January 30th, 2016. For those of you who are listening in the first segment, the gray day is very gone. It's a very beautiful day. There's no gray.
Blue skies.
No gray to be detected.
To be seen, yeah.
See. Yeah.
Good.
Welcome, Jim. Jim Saulnier, Certified Financial Planner, is with us.
Good to be here. How'd you guys do for the first half?
It was very educational.
Yeah, we struggled. Mm-hmm. Barely got through it. Thank goodness you're here.
Thank goodness that you're here, yes. How did the engagement with the hairstylist go?
Went well, don't you agree?
Well, you have headphones on right now, so it's a little hard to tell.
She doesn't puff the hair up like I like, but other than that, it's all right.
It is less puffy than when you left.
Less puffy.
But I assume that was because there's less hair.
To puff.
To puff, yes.
And less gel. I have to put gel in to puff it.
Oh. So did she just de-gelatinize your
hair? She's not a geller. And when she does gel, she doesn't gel up. She gels down.
Oh.
I can't break her that habit.
Huh.
So I don't even bother anymore.
So it's her personal preference. You just let her do her thing.
I let her do her
thing. She uses a lighter gel than you do.
Walked across the street to Starbucks, got my Starbucks, and came to the office.
Did you walk to get your haircut?
Well, no, but you have to park and walk. Can't park in front.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Well, very nice. I'm glad you got your hair adjusted there.
Looking very dapper.
Even though you had to miss the very important Retirement and IRA show.
What'd you guys talk about?
Pete enlightened us as to some ways to protect a spendthrift child from themselves if you have that concern, and be fair to another child who might be more responsible.
Yes.
So a way to kind of be described a situation where you could treat the two of them pretty much the same while exerting some control over the spendthrift and their bad habits.
Wow.
And protecting the the good child, as we would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, the responsible child, probably a better phrase.
Not so much from themselves, but from others.
Yeah.
You should have been here.
I should have.
It was a nice segment.
You may want to listen on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll listen in the morning. Yeah. Actually, Saturday morning I'll be driving to Denver, so I'll listen.
Perfect, in the
time,
car.
Yeah.
I will listen.
Mm-hmm. Tune right on in. So. So I think we did cover that. What would you like to delve into next, Jim? James?
There's nothing else we have to cover? No house cleaning?
There is. Oh, we have a new star.
We have two new stars.
We have, those of you who maybe haven't heard our discussion, we have a nice big map in the studio in the office, and we put stars on all of the states where we have received an email or a phone call as a result of either the radio show, which the Retirement and IRA radio show that you're listening to right now, the website, the retirementandiraShow.com, or jimhelps.com, or helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, which is the blog that Jim and I do, mostly me, on Social Security topics.
I heard that.
And I believe we have a new
two new states.
Ooh, two
new ones. I told you
what
two.
Are the, one, I believe, is North Carolina. Is that
North
true?
Carolina.
North Carolina. Do you know where in North Carolina? So I can...
No idea. Just North Carolina.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a big state. I was...
Well, just put the damn star in the middle of it.
Well, I'm going to have to, since you don't have any information about where these people came from. Just the state of North Carolina. That's...
We've never listed the individual cities.
No, I put the stars kind of close to the city when we know what it is.
Well, he came from Middle North Carolina.
Middleton?
Or Midland.
Okay.
And then the other state.
That state?
Maryland.
Maryland.
I knew I'd get it.
Maryland. Whoa. Maryland. We're going to have a trouble with that.
Maryland's going to be difficult because it's kind of small.
It's... Actually, on this map, it's nice and big. I was worried that the star wouldn't fit on it, but I think we can squeeze it in there.
Well, you get all that space between Maryland and Virginia.
That's where I was headed with this. So
yeah, don't hit Delaware. That'll confuse everyone.
Well, it's a different color on the map, though, so I think we're good to go. So and now we've got if we were trying to do connect the dots, you could now drive from North Carolina all the way to Canada through Vermont, going through states connecting that people have contacted us, because you go North Carolina to Virginia.
No, we're going to get locked up there between New York and New Jersey.
Negative. Go from Pennsylvania to New Jersey to New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, Canada, and you're there.
George Washington Bridge is nightmare, though.
Well, I can see that from here.
Just saying.
I do have a question, though.
Uh-huh.
The caller from the Arctic... I didn't realize that at the
Minnesota?
Very, very up above the very top
above in Manitoba,
the Arctic region up there. So,
who are we trying to reach there?
Because
this one is Japan, this one was Australia. Who was way up there?
Was that Belarus taking the shortcut over the North Pole?
No.
That wasn't a Belarusian.
I think we maybe had somebody from North Saskatoon or something like that. I don't know.
I know we had Japan and Australia and Belarus.
Well, we have stars for those. We didn't put a star for Belarus because that was a joke.
I forgot who was that far north. What's above Manitoba?
Santa Claus.
North Manitoba.
But all lots you iTunian listeners out there, we do this just to let you know. We should actually put our map up on the... website.
We could do an electronic version of the map, and we could update it.
Julia could take a picture of it. And
well, then we have to redo the picture every time we add a star.
Well, if we have an electronic map, we could do that, but we could put it on our Facebook page. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where we put all the fun stuff, just to let people know. But what we do is when an iTunian reaches out to us, we put a star on wherever they came from. Now, in our haste, we didn't get a map of the world. We got a map of just the United States, and then we got questions again from Belarus, Australia, and...
Stop listing Belarus.
Did we not get an email from Belarus?
You personally received one.
Through the radio show's
was
website.
Was a form of a marriage proposal.
Solicitation.
She wasn't asking me to marry her.
It was a solicitation. Right.
She didn't want advice. She wanted Chachi from the radio show.
She was reverse soliciting.
So I sent her a photo of me.
Signed, of course.
Signed, yes.
But that doesn't warrant a star. That's people with a question for the show.
Well, that would be Japan and Australia.
We definitely have those covered. And then Northern...
But what I'm getting at is those countries don't have their own location on our map.
No.
So we just kind of go to the edge of the map and put the star.
Yeah.
And Pete, through his keen eyes, saw... A star north of Manitoba, Canada.
Right.
And I can't for the life of me remember, because I think it's just the North Pole above there.
Right, that's why I think it's Santa Claus.
And what's on the other side?
Well, Russia.
We got a Ukrainian. Could that have been it?
I don't think so, but...
That might have been who we were doing, because we got one from...
From where?
Ukrainia.
Ukraine.
Thank you.
Ukraine, yes. Ukrainian.
Playing the ukulele.
I don't know why I bother. Sometimes. Okay.
Okay,
so,
we need to stop doing this now.
Because we're bantering. We're bantering gonna too much. Upset all our iTunian listeners.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Probably some people in Greeley as well.
Okay, Pete, I want to hit you with something.
Uh-oh. And I duck now?
It has to do a little bit with trust. So it kind of
we
ties
just did that.
I know, but this is something else with okay. trusts. Something totally different. Okay. And then when we come back in the second
third
half of the show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
recovery.
That's recovery. Good.
In the second half of the show, we talk a little bit about the market volatility. And over the past few weeks, now this is Tuesday we're recording this. I don't know how this week is going to fan out.
You
but
don't?
The
if
beginning.
If you did, we could tell people now.
Yes, we could.
And then they'd know how right you were on Saturday.
I have no clue. I tell you, the market will have moved between now and Saturday.
Which way? You got a 50-50 shot.
Both ways. Both on any given day.
Both ways.
Yesterday it was down big, today it's up big. So
like,
who knows?
That's like answering every question yes
but
and
what
no.
I do want to get to is how to view this market volatility. We are not a stock jock show. Never have been, never will be. That was one of the things I wanted to make clear with KFKA when we agreed to do this show. And it's one thing I have carried forward even when we went on to iTunes. I don't want to be a stock jock show. There is plenty of those. Buy this, buy that, sell this, sell that. Instead, we want to give people information on the little-known aspects of retirement planning, little-known aspects of accounts, little-known aspects of estate planning, as we're going to get to in a minute. But I do want to address volatility. I want to address the market volatility because somebody said to me recently, gee, I would hate to have your job right now, Jim. And I asked them why, and they said, well, your phone must be ringing off the hook with all this market volatility. And I said, actually, it isn't. We've had one call. And the one person who did call me is from another state. That's neither here nor there. They used to live in Colorado. It didn't surprise me when she called because she tends to be rather conservative. But after talking to me, she felt fine again. Other than that, we haven't had calls. And I think it's because of the way I present volatility to people, but more importantly, how you and I, Chris, have been preaching for a very long time to try to get people to understand if you can create risk capacity, you may be able to handle market volatility. It's not all about risk tolerance that gets all the attention. It's risk capacity. So I'm going to explain to people, especially if you are in the what we call the transitional phase of retirement or the distributional phase of retirement, how to look at volatility. And of course, if you are still in the accumulation phase of retirement, that means you're probably in your 20s, 30s, 40s, and maybe even early 50s, you should be viewing what's happening right now as an opportunity, not something to be shunned. So I really want to talk to people about volatility and how to view it and how to manage it. So hopefully you are not one of those that are worrying. Because we've had several new appointments recently, several coffees and a second opinion, we call them, Pete. And the people have come into the office several last week and several the week before. It's been a very good 2 weeks for us. But they've been rather nervous. And it's been because they don't quite understand how to view volatility and how if you position a pre- or post-retirement portfolio properly, volatility can actually work to your favor. So I want to talk about a lot of that in the second half of the show, as well as giving everybody an update on what's new with help with mysocialsecurity.com. It is a very good blog, and I'm going to have Chris expand on that. Okay, what I want to get to, Pete, is I want you to save me $600.
Oh, okay.
So I got.
I'm not in the business usually of saving people fees. I'm usually trying to charge those.
All right. So I get an email last week. I get tons of emails. Was it from a viewer or a listener, rather? It
not
was
from Ukraine or Belarus.
No, those no. Actually, no. We did. I told you that we got another Ukrainian.
Well, let's leave that one.
Oh, you don't want to hear it?
No.
Oh, so you got me going. I read it to you last week.
Mm-hmm. Thought you might get more.
No.
You're famous there, I guess.
He burst my bubble, though, because I thought it was a woman, and he Googled the name, and it turned out to be a man.
Oh, I remember that. I saw the pictures of this lovely lady who had a 5 o'clock shadow.
She had pretty much a beard. Well, their names look like a feminine name.
A what?
A feminine name.
Oh.
I screwed it up the first time, but I fixed it the second.
Yeah, you did.
I thought it might be Russian, so I just was clarifying.
Okay, so last week I get an email from a company on seminars, and it was an invitation to attend a seminar on truss decanting. And it began with, understand relevant issues in truss decanting and learn provisions of the Uniform Truss Decanting Act. And it went into a whole paragraph describing what they were going to teach me. And at the end it said, you will be able to review truss modification options, identify decanting goals, and identify the purposes for decanting. I will be able to discuss state decanting laws with my clients, and I will be able to describe the Uniform Truss Decanting Act. And I thought, well, that seems pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. So I
All for free?
No, they had a little register here button. So I went and clicked the register here button, and they wanted $600. And I thought, whoa.
That's where Pete comes in. That's where Pete comes in.
Oh. Because, yeah, normally maybe I would pay $600, not all the time, but that was a little steep, I thought. I'm attending another online seminar next month, which was only $200, a lot more affordable. And I thought, well, for $600, I could attend a seminar, or for free, I could nail Pete with this during a radio show. So I'm just going to go out on a limb and assume, because you are one of the best estate planning attorneys I know, and I say that with all due respect, you are a wonderful man, and I'm privileged to have you on the show. Your knowledge is well respected.
Okay, I'll answer it.
I am clueless on what truss decanting is and all these other items, and I thought maybe you could not only educate me, let our listeners know, is this decanting something people would trust? Do you have to add this to the trust? Is it something that's there? And what is it? How would we use it? And why would somebody with a trust even want to care about it?
Okay. This starts out, and of course, we've had a number of changes in not only the tax laws, but state laws, different things. The decanting is a technique where you can actually change or modify an irrevocable trust.
So a trust that was created to never be changed, hence the name of irrevocable. Irrevocable.
There you go. You can go that route.
Can be revoked.
No.
Oh.
It can be modified, amended, changed.
Well, that's revoking it.
No. It's like canceling it. Yeah. Revoking would be undoing it.
What the heck is the difference between the word cancel and revoke? I've revoked my citizenship. I've canceled my citizenship.
That's the point. That means the same thing. He's just talking about modifying it, making some changes to it.
Yes.
But not taking all the money out and destroying the trust.
Okay. So the money stays in a trust, but the terms can be changed.
Can be changed, correct. And
okay.
It's not unlimited, but it gives us the ability to modify. And really where the decanting kicks in, because the trust, the irrevocable trust that we construct now, have the ability to change built in to the trust.
So all newer trusts you do have decanting language in them?
No. All of the irrevocable trusts that I do have the ability built in to modify them at a later date.
How do you build that into them?
Typically what we'll use is something called a trust protector, who is some third party, not the creator of the trust. We call them the trust maker, not the trustee, not the beneficiary, but this is some person or some entity, be it a corporation, trust company, what have you, that when we set the trust up, we make provision for the appointment of a trust protector or actually name a trust protector. And then in the trust document, we say what are the things that the trust protector can change down the road. And it can be a whole list of different things, typically. And that's where really the challenge is. In constructing these, is what things do we want to leave the door open for modification later? Obviously, any changes in the tax laws that would frustrate what our client is trying to do with the irrevocable trust. For example, what we've seen of late is because of the higher estate tax exemption amounts that the focus really has become on income tax planning. And Jim, we've talked about that quite a bit, that the trusts are really getting nailed on income taxes these days. So if we've built that in, say that we did a trust 2 years ago and we gave the trust protector the ability to modify the trust to accommodate these changes in the income tax laws where we could minimize or eliminate the income tax inside the trust, then we can do that through the use of the trust protector, who would then sign an amendment changing the trust within the area that they have the ability to do it, in this case, tax law. The other is we could give them the ability to name additional beneficiaries. We could give them the ability to eliminate beneficiaries, to remove trustees, to appoint trustees, to fill vacancies if there's a trustee vacancy, those sorts of things. We can grant other sorts of what you'll see very typically is their ability to grant a power of appointment. And that's more of a technical term, but it would be a method that we could eliminate the generation skipping tax. So those sorts of things, they tend to be narrowly defined. They're a little different than decanting because it's already into the trust. But if we have a trust, say, from 15 years ago, before trust protectors came into to vogue, then decanting may be our only recourse at that point in time. And so what?
So does the trust? A few questions on this trust protector.
Okay.
That right. is the you put language in to appoint a person or a corporation as this "quote unquote" protector.
Right.
Does the creator of the trust also list what the trust "quote unquote" protector can change?
Yes.
Can this trust protector be a family member, or is it an attorney? Is it? I've never heard of a corporation that specializes in being trust protectors.
Some of the trust companies will serve that capacity if they're not serving as trustee of the trust.
And why are they called protectors? What are they protecting?
Well, where it started was with the Offshore Asset Protection Trust, the trust that would be sited in Isle of Man or Nevis or Cook Islands that the very wealthy would use to move money out of the reach of their creditors in a foreign jurisdiction. And that's a whole nother show to talk about. And we would use trust protectors in those cases. So let's say I set up an asset protection trust and it's sited in the Cook Islands. A sited means that's where the trust is, that's where the trustee is. And I'm a co-trustee with the Cook Island trustee. And I have this huge judgment. I get after I set it up, then I get sued at some point in time, and I have this huge judgment against me. And the court orders me to distribute all of the trust assets to this creditor. Well, the trust protector sitting in the Cook Islands or Isle of Man or whatever jurisdiction has the veto authority that if I am ordered to do something under duress, they can then veto my order to distribute all the assets out of the trust and cancel it, making it ineffective. And so the trust protector is protecting the trust from these sorts of things. And it would also pertain to creditors. They'd have the ability, if necessary, to relocate the trust to a different jurisdiction if that were appropriate. But that's where it came from, these trust protectors sitting out there, and they were kind of the guardians of the assets of the trust to prevent creditors from getting inside the trust. Based on a judgment against the creator and beneficiary of the trust. So that's where it came from. And then when they moved onshore as a result of Congress's enamoration, I guess that's the word, with sunsetting all of our tax laws, we never knew what we were going to be dealing with. So the trust protector concept was brought onshore, and we used trust protectors to adjust the trust for changes in the law primarily. But it's expanded beyond that.
So we've got the three-finger salute from Chris. So we have to hurry up. We have 3 minutes. I assume that's what that means.
For this segment.
As it's meant for the past 5 years.
Okay, perfect. Mm-hmm. So you set up a trust. You have a trust protector who is granted certain authorities. Let's talk a little bit about why you would want to be this proactive, because an irrevocable trust is created, I think, to complete a gift.
Yes.
So you've totally passed the asset or the money on. It's no longer yours. Legally, the gift is completed. Years ago, that was very important. Today, maybe not so much, but for a variety of reasons, you may want this asset totally out of your control, out of your estate, away from your creditors, whatever the case may be. So you have to complete the gift. That means you have no more control over the gift and what happens.
Right.
So you create a trust, and it has to be irrevocable. In other words, you can't go back and make changes. However, you know things...
You can make changes. You just can't get the money back out
right.
on your demand.
But in order to make these changes, you have to have the proper language in there for this protector to trigger the change so you can react, as you just said, to changes in tax laws. 5-6 years ago, it was all about saving estate taxes. Now it's all about saving income taxes.
Correct.
So you may need to get proper language in that trust to roll with the punches, so to speak, mm-hmm. and change as things change. And that's where then decanting comes in. Do all states allow it? Do some states not allow it? And then I would imagine there's certain rules that have to be followed to now move or to empty one trust into another. Is that what's happening?
Yes, but that's different than trust protector.
Oh.
Right. And I would assume it's kind of a tightrope you walk to have certain controls or things that could be changed while maintaining the completed gift aspect of it. Because if the... You know where I'm getting,
yes.
where I'm going
yeah.
on this,
yeah.
where so there's too much control maintained, then you don't have a complete
right. If you
gift,
control no. that asset, you haven't right. made the gift,
right.
so it can be pulled back into your estate at your passing. It could be subject to your creditors. You have to give up access and control.
Correct.
But putting in this trust protector and the decanting provisions, I suppose, allow within limits certain changes to be made, at least to react to tax law changes and other things.
We can fix the trust down the road.
Okay.
Perfect.
Interesting.
So when we get back from this next break, we'll delve into this a little deeper. Pete will get into specifically what decanting is, how it might differ from the trust protector situation he started off with. Good stuff, though. So a topic we haven't talked about before on the Retirement and IRA Show. When we come back, we are going to hear the number one song from 40 years ago this week. This week's hit song uses the roller coaster as a metaphor for the ups and downs of dating.
Oh, God, I'm an expert on that one.
You ride that roller coaster, right?
Many a times.
So this is the Retirement and IRA Show.
I'm still on it.
Right. We'll be back with you right after this short break. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That is the number one song from 40 years ago this week. Very popular song, very easily identified, I think. Jim, I'll give you this one. I asked Pete last time, so it's your turn.
Well, I'm going to go out and say, it's either Roller Coaster or Roller Coaster of Love.
Close. It's Love Roller Coaster.
I got it backwards.
Mm-hmm. No, I got it. By whom?
Some disco group.
I thought you loved this music.
I do. It's from the 70s, but I don't remember the group. I'm going to go out on a limb
really?
And say they're a disco group.
Mm-hmm. How about the name of the or album that it was on? No.
Love Stinks?
It's Ohio Players.
Ah, Ohio Players.
Ohio Players. Hmm. From the great state of?
Alabama.
Missouri. Yeah.
Well, here's the fun fact about this here. There's a persistent urban legend about this song that a murder had occurred within the walls of the recording studio during the taping of this song and that a scream can be heard in the background.
Ooh.
And I actually fast-forwarded to this spot. It occurs at approximately a minute 25 into the song. We didn't listen to that much of it to get to it. There's
so who's
kind
screaming?
Of a blood-curdling scream kind of in the background.
Huh.
DJ Casey Kasem, you know him, right?
Not personally.
Okay. Further popularized the myth on his radio show, American Top 40. The truth is that the scream that was caught on tape came from band member Billy Beck, who had hit a higher pitch note than he intended and in kind of a dramatic fashion, and it sounded like a scream. So, I would have to give them props if there were a murder took place during the recording of the song and they didn't miss a beat and they just kept on going. That is dedication to your
that
music
is.
Right there. So I would tend to believe what the debunking of that urban legend. So this is the Retirement and IRA Show. We are in the midst. We're right in the bog of a
but not
a,
bogging
a
down
trust
decanting
of trust decanting, which is a topic we haven't spoken of before. We've mentioned it. We haven't actually gotten to the decanting aspect, though. We described the fact that an irrevocable trust actually can be modified after being created and funded, which a lot of people don't believe. Jim was a bit surprised, I think, that there was changes that could be made, even though it was still an irrevocable trust and held up as a irrevocable trust and didn't give up the title and features of an irrevocable trust, even though it had aspects that could be changed. So Pete did, a great job describing the types of things that could be changed and kind of supplying the logic of why you would want to change things. The world changes, the tax situation changes, the rules and regulations, particularly between countries, can change. Your situation with regard to creditors can change. So it might be a good idea for the benefits, so the trust can accomplish what it was meant to accomplish, to be able to change certain aspects of it.
And do they call it decanting? Because you're moving from one to another. It's like
we haven't gotten to that yet. He's going to tell us.
All right, never mind.
You're reading ahead, Jim.
Yes. So, Pete, what exactly is trust decanting?
Well, I was ready to say it.
He's the guy, though.
Well, Jim, what did
I'm thinking it's like a decanter when you're pouring liquid from...
Like wine, you're decanting wine. That's actually where it comes from.
So we're oxygenating the trust?
Yes, we are oxygenating it by pouring it into a different vessel from the one in which it arrived.
Mm-hmm. But there's probably certain rules on what the receiving vessel can say or do.
So mechanically, we have this irrevocable trust, probably doesn't have a trust protector, or if it does... The changes that are required are not included in the powers of the trust protector, so we're kind of stuck. But we want to fix it because something has caused us to need to make that change. So the way that it works is we create a brand new irrevocable trust with the provisions that we want. We then transfer, decant, the assets of the old trust into the new trust. Now, that has to be statutorily authorized. That means that the state law has to permit that. Colorado does not. New York, I think, was the first state to allow decanting, and a number of other states have followed suit. And before all said and done, I think all states are going to allow decanting. But what we've been doing up till this point, for example, if we had an irrevocable trust in Colorado that we needed to make some changes in, did not have a trust protector, there was no other way that we could do it, we would relocate that trust to, say, New York, make it a resident of New York, what we call changing the situs, S-I-T-U-S, the site where it's located. And then all of a sudden we're under New York law and we have the ability to prepare the new trust and decant the old trust into the new.
And are there restrictions as to the domicile of the trustee or the beneficiaries or the trust maker with regards to moving a trust from one state to another, or is it, you're free to do that?
Well, you're generally free to do it, but the way that it's moved, since the trust is not a concrete, tangible entity, much like a corporation, we can't invite it to dinner. So what we have to do and look to, and generally the domicile, if you will, that's the same as situs, the domicile of the trust is going to be where the trust is administered, which happens to be where the trustee is located. Now, you can have trustees, co-trustees from different states, but there will be one state where the trust is really administered. That's where it files its income tax returns for that state, those sorts of things. Just like where you as an individual, your domicile might be where you actually live and file your tax home, if it were. So if we're going to move it to New York, then we generally are going to have to obtain a New York trustee to be one of the trustees so that we can obtain that situs or domicile in the state of New York in order to make ourselves subject to the New York law.
Are there restrictions of what can be inside the trust to make that kind of move from one state to another?
Generally not. I've not seen any of the state decanting laws that would restrict the assets owned by the trust, and it could include even real estate.
That's located. Where I was going. Most things you could move with the trust if you had to. Obviously, real estate you could not.
Right.
So it's possible you could have a trust, an irrevocable trust that was set up and is currently administered in Colorado that holds real estate, Colorado real estate within it, and it could be moved to a state such as New York that allows decanting, while maintaining that Colorado real estate inside of it, and that's not a problem.
That's not a problem. Now, interesting. Again, the decanting laws are state-specific, so there could be some states that are going to restrict the ability to do that with real estate, but I've not seen any, but I haven't read them all either. Colorado does have a decanting law that is currently being studied, and as far as I know, has not been introduced to the legislature yet. And probably not ready to be introduced this year. That tends to have to go through any number of committees at the Bar Association and other committees that may be affiliated with that, investment folks and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, it's under consideration and study, and I think that we'll have one at some point. We just don't currently.
Well, this seems I'll let you talk in a minute, Jim. I'm kind of
listening.
A strange show.
I know.
But
I'm enjoying it. Plus, I'm sick.
Oh,
well, really?
Sorry to hear that.
I'm feeling a cold coming.
Really?
Oh, yeah. That's kind of been going around a little bit. I know a number of people.
I think someone in the office gave it to me.
Oh. Well, I haven't had it yet, so I'll stay away. The
I won't kiss you
One
later.
Thing that just seems bizarre to me, that someone with the trust, so I'm assuming the trustee, has to authorize the decanting. Mm-hmm. You know, they're willing to allow these assets to then be poured into the new trust. The trustee would be allowed to do something that drastic, but could not authorize the changes that they want to make to the trust, because the end result is the same.
It is.
This seems like a bizarre, lengthy, multi-step, expensive legal process
mm-hmm.
that is almost unnecessary, that if the trustee has that power to affect that change, ultimately have those assets end up in a trust that has these XYZ provisions in it, why can they not have the power to just make those provision changes in the existing trust? That is, I guess, the first, my knee-jerk reaction is, my goodness, why do we have to jump through these hoops when the end result could be the same?
Well, if the trust does not authorize the trustee to make those types of changes, but let's just say that you're thinking down the road when you construct the trust and you authorize the trustee to make those adjustments, they can. Depending on who the trustee is, that may or may not be a good thing with regard to the goals of the trust. In other words, if the trustee has too much authority, then the assets in the trust could be included in their estate at their death, because now they have too much control over this. If they can control who enjoys the property, their access to it without any restrictions, then there's a good chance that it could be included in their estate. We're setting up a new trust, and very often the trustee is going to be the same, with the exception, if let's assume that we're in a state and we don't have to change states, then the trustee of the new trust is likely to be the same trustee of the old trust. And so as a result, what we're doing is we're just giving that trustee control under a different document than we did before. And mm-hmm. and there are restrictions. You can't just go in and change it totally. Within the state laws, there are restrictions on what you can change and to what extent. It may be a situation where you can change it. It's just that the beneficiaries have to be the same. You can't change their access to assets, which is probably not the case, but the beneficiaries, you can't change their proportion that they would receive or who the beneficiaries are. One of the trustees has to be the same. You know, it could be each state's going to decide on their own what sort of requirements there's going to be to actually move those assets into a new trust.
But I think the overall take I want our listeners to know on this is when you do an irrevocable gift, that is a big decision for many people. They don't want to give up access and control to something that was once theirs. And in order to make the gift legal, you have to give up access and control to it. So there's many reasons why you would want a gift. Nowadays, for the majority of our listeners, it's not really about estate taxes anymore. The limits are so darn high. But you may want to make a completed gift to get an asset out of the reach of maybe a bankruptcy or a creditor, or perhaps for Medicaid planning. I don't want to read too much into that, but some people do start to gift assets long before Medicaid may become an issue. So for a variety of reasons, you may want to make a permanent gift, but you worry, what if things change? And not so much things where you're going to want to close the trust and take the money out, because you can't do that. You can't undo the gift. But what if things change with the legal ramifications or the law or a beneficiary dies or something, so you can make these types of I guess, polishing it almost. It's like you're polishing the apple. You're not eating the apple.
Or tweaking it.
Tweaking it. Yeah.
And all of this was brought about by the constant sunsetting of the tax laws. We never knew at the time that the client died what the laws were going to be and what the tax rules were going to be. So we took our best guess at it, but then had to build in the ability to adjust based on changes in the tax law. For example, even today I was looking at an irrevocable life insurance trust that for a client, it's not a current client of ours, I was working through one of their advisors, but they didn't need the life insurance trust, which was set up for estate tax purposes. They want the life insurance, but they don't need the life insurance trust. So how do they get it out of the trust and yet keep the policy? And so those are a lot of the work that we're doing with the irrevocable trust because the tax laws have changed so substantially, estate tax, that we don't have a need for these irrevocable trusts anymore. The other is the income tax aspect, because all of a sudden trusts are subject to much higher rates on income tax, how do we adjust the trust for that? Because no one was anticipating that. And so those provisions aren't in those trusts, and as a consequence, the trusts are paying maximum income tax rates when they really don't have to.
Good. Well, hopefully, excuse me, our listeners got a little bit of an insight out of that. I know I did. I know Pete just saved me $600. So want to thank you for that, so I don't have to attend that course now. But a little bit of information on trust decanting. This is why we like having an actual attorney on here, an actual estate planning attorney, who can add this type of value and insight to the show. We call it the Retirement and IRA Show, but estate planning is a crucial part of what we assist our clients in doing. And we often tell clients, or I try to tell clients, I wish estate planning wasn't called estate planning, because everybody thinks it's about dying. Proper estate planning is not necessarily about dying. It's putting in place a plan to help you if you become incapacitated, to make sure that your assets are being monitored and taken care of if you're incapacitated, and of course at your demise that your assets go to who you want them to in the most tax advantaged manner possible. So estate planning is about living and, yes, about dying. And this decanting obviously has to do with the living side, but it's for those of you who, for a variety of reasons, may decide to make a permanent gift but want to protect that gift from whoever you're giving it to, maybe from their creditors, predators, bankruptcy, divorced spouses, and you want to protect it. You want to give that gift some protection, so you put it in a trust, but then lo and behold, some things change, and you're thinking, oh my God, the trust is no longer good anymore, or if we would have known this at the time, we would have never done that. Decanting through and this trust protector provision are just ways that people can prepare for the unexpected.
Well, and I don't want to limit the use of these techniques to lifetime gifts, because using a will or a revocable living trust following the client's death, those trusts are irrevocable also. So the trust that they set up for their spouse, the trust they set up for their kids,
need these provisions as well.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay, so hopefully people got a good bit of understanding out of that, and you have some good ideas to bring up with your own estate planning attorney when you breach the topic of trust with them. Now I want to get into, how much time do we have left, Pete?
We have
Chris.
9 minutes.
And I would say break. 9 as well.
Is that what you were going to say, Pete?
Yeah, since you asked me first.
Well, you were on my mind.
Yes, indeed.
A couple of weeks ago, I kept saying Ed because I had a slot on my mind. So,
your mind's very sticky.
What's sticky?
Your mind is very sticky. Something gets in there, it just kind of sticks in there.
Okay, Pete.
Exactly.
Thanks, Pete.
You're welcome.
But let's change topics now, and we're going to talk a little bit about the market volatility, and then Chris will give us an update at the beginning of the fourth segment on what's new on Help with My Social Security, and then I'll finish with my little market volatility tirade. And
Are you warning us ahead of time it's going to turn into a
tirade? No. It's not going to be not going to be like my Social Security tirade. I just really want people to understand volatility is perfectly normal, perfectly natural. I don't know, for some reason, humans are being led to believe that the weather should always be sunny, that there should never be an unexpected storm, or it should never get below a certain temperature anymore or above another temperature.
No gray skies, in other words.
Everything should be moderate temperatures, 70, sunny skies, modest wind. And just, I mean, everything should be perfect.
I think you've described Hawaii.
Okay, everything should be Hawaii. It shouldn't be like the top of Aspen Mountain. Mm. So what we know with the weather is volatile, weather constantly changes. For some reason, people feel the same thing about investments. Now, today I'm going to be addressing market volatility, and for the market I'm talking more broadly in terms of perhaps the Dow Jones or the S&P or the NASDAQ. Those are the three big ones everybody hears of. Of course, it is impossible to direct directly into an index or a market. You can do that through some investment vehicles. But what I want to talk about is the fact that stocks now are moving down, and people, Chris, are actually acting surprised.
Which is surprising to me as well.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we've had quite a long time of mostly up.
Right. And people, I think, act surprised because, first of all, they actually believe when they get their statement, that's the money they have. That has got to be the biggest fallacy out there that I try to get people to understand. Your statement is not what you have. It's what you had. It's what you had on the day the custodian printed that statement. It's what you would have had had you called the custodian on that day and said, sell and move me to cash. Because that's the only way that money is truly yours. Other than that, the custodian is just sending you a snapshot in time of what you would have had in the past, usually the previous month or the previous quarter, usually at the end of the month or the end of the quarter, what you would have had on that date. It's not what you have now. It's what you had. But more importantly, when Wall Street has your money, and I do not use the term Wall Street in a derogatory manner like many politicians do, but what I'm saying is when your money is invested, when it's with Wall Street, so to speak, that's the parlance we use, but in reality, you have invested in corporations. When you've invested in U.S. corporations and global corporations and you buy shares of their stock, meaning you own a portion of that company, when you own corporate America and global corporations, that money is not yours anymore. The corporation doesn't even have it, but it's exposed to the whims of the markets. It's not yours. It's not in the bank. You want safe money, you put it in the bank. The money in the bank is yours, and the federal government backs it through the FDIC, so there's a little bit of protection there, things that they didn't offer during the Great Depression, and when a bank went bust, you lost all your money. Now we have some protections. But you have to understand you have an investment. It's not yours, and your statement was just a snapshot in time. Nowadays, we have the computer, and you can tell what you would have had right up to that day. But again, it's a snapshot in time, people. It's only if you would have sold at that moment, that's what you would have had. Other than that, it's going to be subject to the whims of the market. So that's the first thing I wanted people to understand. All too often, especially during this very strong recovery since March of 2009, and the markets have been moving up, people, Pete, look at their statements and they see it rising and rising and rising, and they think, oh my God, I'm making a lot of money. You don't make anything. You're a tax attorney, Pete. Do you pay taxes on any of that? Now, I know there could be distributions on some of the holdings, but you don't pay taxes every year until when?
Until you realize the gain is the parlance.
Exactly. Until you sell. Until the government says, look, if you bought something at 50 and it's worth 100, good for you. We're not going to tax it, though, until you sell it. Why are they going to wait until you sell it? Because it's not yours yet. It can drop more. It can rise more. Only when you sell, people, is the money yours. Think of it as safe money and risk money. So if you have money in the risk category, it's going to go up and down. The question then becomes, how do you manage that expectation? How do you deal with that? Well, I got news for you. Equities are like a commodity. And if you keep that in mind, let me ask you, Chris, in all honesty, both Pete, you and Chris answer this question.
Seems like a lot of pressure.
When you went to the gas station earlier this week and filled up at $1.60 a gallon, did you refuse to pay $1.60 a gallon because you're waiting for it to get to back to $5 a gallon where it was 3 years ago? Or were you comfortable paying $1.60 a gallon?
I was pretty comfortable. I was waiting a little bit for it to go to $1.50.
Okay, you wait for it to drop more. Pete, were you upset paying $1.60 and demanding to pay $5 where it was 3 years ago, or were you okay paying $1.60?
No, I went up to the window and thanked the clerk for allowing me to purchase at $1.60.
Precisely. Gasoline is a commodity. It's a sale when we see it dropping. Equities, if you look at them in the same vein, are on sale when they're dropping. Yet equities are the only commodity people love to pay full price for. When gas was $5 a gallon, I didn't pull in my big F-250 diesel, and diesel was getting over $5.50 a gallon, and you had the little signs on there, this pump stops at $75, and you had to re-put your card in for the next $75, and you still didn't have the damn diesel truck filled yet because it holds 28 stupid gallons of diesel. There was my rant. I did not pull in and fill up at $1.93 a gallon for diesel earlier this week, complaining that I wasn't getting it at $5. But with equities, people would not come into my office and say, wow, it must be tough in your business. Stocks are at an all-time high. Instead, when people come in and stocks are at an all-time high, they want to buy. They insist. They love paying full price for stocks. They despise buying stocks on sale. They despise buying them when they're down 10, 15, 20%. They panic. Like, oh my God, I don't want to buy stocks. They're down 20%. I want to sell. Yet when they're at an all-time high, they keep coming into my office wanting to buy more. Jim, stocks are at an all-time high. Let's buy more. That goes against the very grain of when you go to fill up your tank with gas. So you have to understand that that's how equities work. And how can we position your portfolio so you're not panicking so much? Because that, Pete, is ultimately what people are doing. They're panicking because they think they can't afford to lose anything. And I'm going to teach you in the next segment how you can feel comfortable losing.
Perfect. So this is the Retirement and IRA Show. We will be back with the rest of this story. Just getting good here. Right after this short break. When we come back from the break, though, we're going to hear the number one song from 35 years ago this week. This hit was originally released in 1967 by a Jamaican group called The Paragons. It was redone by this blonde artist that has had multiple number one hits. We'll find out who that is.
Blonde artist?
Right after this short break. Welcome back to the Retirement and IRA Show. That was the number one song 35 years ago this week in 1981, knocking off our friend John Lennon, who after 5 weeks...
You mean that figuratively, right?
Yes, figuratively.
Okay, good.
John Lennon finally succumbs to the new number one hit, The Tide is High, by the American rock band Blondie.
It did have that Jamaican sound to it.
It did.
And we really liked recording that in the studio. It was one, not one of my favorites that we did, but you realize I played bass for Blondie.
You did?
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, look it up sometime.
When did you play bass?
Well, back in the late 70s and early 80s.
When you were?
A rocker.
Eight?
Mm-hmm. When I was a rocker. It was a previous life. This is, you know, not my first career.
So let me guess, her drummer was named Chris Stein.
No, her bass player.
Her bass player was named
Chris
Stein.
I played bass. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. I'm serious.
I believe you.
You don't sound convinced, but
Okay. I believe her bass
player
was Chris
Stein. So why the
heck do
we listen to these songs in this strange, from 1935, 1976?
It's how we lead into our blog, What's New on HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com. Should
That's
I
all you're
going to
say?
Well,
yeah.
I was trying
okay,
to be,
fine.
I was
here.
Trying to be pithy.
Probably a good idea.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
So this week on HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com, and it is that is the website, by the way, folks. The big long word all run together. HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com, just like it sounds. No spaces or dashes. No punctuation of any kind, except for the dot before the com. And it might be helpful to put the www in front of it, but you don't need it. That's
you don't
optional
need it
all these days.
And you could just go into the Google search box, and you could put spaces if you'd like, help with my Social Security, and it'll find
perfect.
Blog.
So if you go there this week, you're going to find the new post entitled Recovering from the Earnings Test. We had previously blogged on the earnings test, which is something that people claiming their Social Security benefits before full retirement age, the earnings test is something they're exposed to, which limits the amount they can earn in wages while collecting benefits and avoid having their benefits reduced. If you earn over a certain amount, which in the year 2016 is $15,720, if you earn more than that, they're going to withhold your benefits at the rate of $1 for every $2 that you earn over the limit. That's only in the months before you reach your full retirement age, which for most people is 66 or somewhere between 66 and 67, depending on the year that you were born. What we hadn't gone into, and the justification for this blog post, is what really happens to that? Or do you really just lose that money, or does it come back to you? And we alluded in the past that it came back to you. But in the form in which it comes back is kind of misunderstood. It does not come back to you in one lump sum. Let's say between 62 and 66, you're claiming benefits while working, and they reduce your benefits for some amount during those years. Once you reach your full retirement age, they're actually going to recalculate your benefit, giving you credit for the dollars they withheld during your pre-full retirement years, pre-full retirement age years. And I give you a specific example. I'm not going to run through the whole thing here, otherwise this would become the blog post itself. But I give what I hope is an easy-to-follow example using real numbers about how that recalculation would work. It doesn't all just come back to you. They don't send you a check and say, oh, here's all the money we withheld from you. They recalculate your benefit as if you hadn't claimed as early as you really did. So your monthly benefit will increase. And then over enough time, if you live long enough, you'll get all of the money back they withheld and possibly more.
Right. You have to live to your life expectancy that Social Security is factoring in for males and females. That's the catch. Because sometimes you'll read an article, Chris, where the author of the article or the reporter in the article will say, oh, you don't lose your benefits. You'll get it back. Because some advisors and some Social Security pundits will say, oh, you lose your benefits under the work test. You don't technically lose them. You'll get them. But what they're not telling you is you have to live to full life expectancy to get them back.
Right.
If you pass away sooner than full life expectancy, you won't get them back.
And in the example I use, using the numbers just to let a little bit of the cat out of the bag, just maybe the nose and a few whiskers. A person with the example that I use that reaches full retirement age and gets recalculated has to live to 81 in order to recover all the money that was withheld. If you live longer than that, you get back more. If you live less than that, you don't get it all back.
So perfect.
That's what's new on HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com.
What's new, pussycat?
Perfect. Hopefully people will go to that blog. That blog is growing in popularity. We get email questions from it. We get people signing up for an email newsletter. And scheduling a coffee and a second opinion, which is something I want to chat about real quickly, is, again, Pete and I are both practicing in our respective fields. Pete is an estate planning attorney, soon to be a retired estate planning attorney, but still practicing.
Not soon enough.
So why don't you know, Pete, on that vein, if you want to meet with Pete, he has others that are taking over some of his work.
Right.
And I'm sure he would not direct you to someone who wouldn't take care of you. So don't hesitate to contact Pete, even though he's retiring. He will make sure you get connected with someone who can help you with your particular estate planning issue.
Yep, exactly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as I said, Pete is retiring this year. He will be on the show in limited capacity after the end of January. We'll probably drag you on once a month, maybe twice if I can get a gun to your back. He will be on at least once a week, and once a month on the show. And then in time, we'll probably replace him permanently and then talk really nasty things about him once he's gone.
Yeah.
He could also phone in to the...
I could. I could call in
the show.
He could call in.
Start a new Stump the Chump sort of thing going.
But we, in my office, we're not going anywhere. We're not retiring. I'm still too young for that. But if people do want to schedule an appointment with us, we offer Social Security analysis, as we've talked about before. We offer retirement planning, which is what we specialize in. But it all begins with what we call the coffee and a second opinion. And this offer is for iTunians as well as people right here in Northern Colorado. Of course, in Colorado, you can come right into our office. If you're listening to us off of iTunes, we hold this as a phone call. And what we offer on this Coffee and a Second Opinion is just a chance to chat, get an idea of your particular situation, find out what your concerns are, answer some of your questions, and hopefully point you in the right direction. So we do not charge for that Coffee and a Second Opinion. If you're in Colorado, you'll probably come into our Fort Collins or Loveland office. I highly recommend the Fort Collins office because the coffee selection is far superior than our Loveland office, which doesn't have coffee. You just have ice water. But that's because in Loveland, we only rent a room in a main office building, and they, for some reason, don't have coffee. But in our office, which I own, we have copious amounts of coffee.
Copious.
Through our Keurig system. And of course, if you're an iTunian listener, we will mail you a coffee pod if you'd like. And if you have a Keurig on your own, you can make your own free cup of coffee. But we will chat over the phone with our iTunian listeners. So if anybody wants to schedule this coffee and a second opinion, get a better handle of your finances and your retirement especially, just go to my website, Jim Helps. That's Jim Helps. HELPS.com. Click on the Contact Us button, which is in the upper right-hand corner of the website. You can't miss it. Or click on the photo of Chris, myself, and Justin. That will take you to our personal pages, and you can schedule an appointment that way as well. And you were staring at the map. I caught you.
I'm
trying to figure out that star on the top of Manitoba, aren't
you? Well, that's where it started, but then I'm always fascinated by the size of the Great Lakes.
They are pretty big.
They are enormous.
That's why they call them great.
They're very great. But I don't believe they're the greatest. I think the largest lake in the world is in Russia somewhere.
That makes sense. Russia's a big state. Country.
Very big.
Very big.
Mm-hmm. But these, you look at how big, I mean, the Great Salt Lake, that's big.
But that
even
looks
Yellowstone
tiny.
Lake is big.
Yeah, it's tiny.
Lake Pontchartrain is big. The Lake Okeechobee in Florida, that's
but
big.
But tiny compared to the Great Lakes.
Compared to the Great Lakes.
Yes.
Tiny.
Tiny.
You could fit all of them in one of the Great Lakes.
And have room to spare.
Yeah, but this lake in Russia, and I need to figure out which one it is. I think the statement I just heard on the television recently, some huge amount, like 10 to 20% of all the fresh water on Earth
is in that lake.
Wow.
That's
a
big
lake. That's how big it is. Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to what I was talking about. God bless you.
Thank you.
So what I want to finish is hopefully people understand your statement is just a snapshot in time. The money is not yours until you realize it. That's the legal parlance in the eyes of the government, or when you sell and move from a risk asset to a safe asset. While the money is invested, it is exposed to the whims of the market. Stocks go up, stocks go down. But if you look at stocks for what they are, a commodity, they are a product, they are something that you buy and sell. Think of it very similar to gasoline. For some reason, people hated paying $5 a gallon for gasoline, but loved paying $1.50 for gasoline. Yet, for some reason, when it comes to equities, people love buying stocks at all-time highs or at, quote-unquote, $5 a gallon, and hate buying equities when they're at $1.50 a gallon or at a new low. And it's because people, Pete, don't quite understand risk. As humans, we fall victim to what is called framing. When you look at a picture in a frame, you only see things through the eyes of that picture. Everything happened in that picture is what's going to happen forever. And we tend to take that same behavioral concept and apply it to finances. So when we look at stocks going up and reaching new highs, we frame it in our mind that they're going to just keep going up. And when we're looking at stocks going down, we frame it in our mind as, oh my God, they're just going to keep going down and I'm going to lose all this money. The reality is that's what they normally do. So in order for us to help people, because remember, we work predominantly with retirees, I want to break people into one of three categories. Pre-retirees, or what we call accumulation savers, what we call transitional people. These are people moving from the accumulation phase to what we call the distribution or retirement phase. So you have accumulation, transition, and decumulation. Decumulation is when you're essentially spending your money. You can't take it with you, so you have to spend it and make sure it lasts for the rest of your life. During the accumulation phase, that's the easy part. That's when we're in our 20s, 30s, and 40s. Anybody listening right now in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, if you are panicking over the market, you don't get what's happening. Because when you are 30 and put money in your 401k, that's not money for you to spend in 5 years. That's money for you to spend in 40 years. You're going to spend it in a period of time longer than you're already alive. You're only 30. You're going to spend it in 40 years when you're 70. So what you have to understand is that's just simply the 30-year-old buying something for the 70-year-old. And if equities are going down in price, that's a sale. That's nothing to be panicking over. You should be excited because every month as you are saving in your 401k, every time you are putting your contribution and your employer puts their match, hopefully, you're buying more shares as the markets are going down. You're buying gas at $4 a gallon and then $3 a gallon and then $2 a gallon. You should be happy. You are buying more stock for the same amount of money than you did the month before. So when you're adding money to your portfolio during the accumulation phase, down periods shouldn't panic you at all. I think one of the best things they could do is just not send people statements. Especially if you're in your 20s, 30s, or 40s. You don't even get to see what you got. Because that's what causes the panic. Oh my God, it's down from last month. I'm going to sell.
Of course, this is all based on the assumption that the world is not coming to an end.
True.
If you take the view that it's only downhill from here and never to go back up, you should be panicking. The question is, how rational is that?
Right.
Conclusion?
If the Walking Dead is coming, but right. It doesn't matter
right.
At that point.
Right. And that's
if
my argument, too.
If the world is coming to an end, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Stocks are the last thing you need to worry about. You need canned goods and ammunition.
Exactly.
So if you believe over the long haul that corporations we've been talking about are going to be making more money in the future than they are today, that in the long term,
absolutely.
Things are going to work out.
Absolutely.
But in the short term, we see this volatility. And it's
but I wouldn't even give any credence. If anybody came in and they said, I feel that the whole financial system is a hoax, it's all going to collapse, we're going to be living in caves and bartering. Okay, well, I can't really help you. That's not. Find an advisor who specializes in
bartering. That's not our specialty.
That's not what we look at. So what I wanted to get younger people to know in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, please understand volatility, downward pressure on equities is an opportunity for you to buy more at a lower price. It's the same as you pulling into the gas station and filling up at $1.60 instead of $5 where it was a few years ago. You're just getting things on sale. Now it gets tricky as you get into the transitional phase. Now you're getting into the people we specialize in. That's people getting into the early to mid-50s and beyond. Because now you're probably within 8 to 12 years of retirement in the transitional phase. Why do I call it the transitional phase? Well, you're too old at that point to truly be an accumulation investor because the recovery could take years. I freely admit that.
Essentially, your long term is becoming more short term.
Exactly. So when you're in your 30s, it doesn't matter if it took 8 years to recover from the low. You've got 40 years to go. That just gives you 8 more years to buy things on sale.
However, if you are 52 and say, and you want to retire at 60 and it takes 8 years to recover, that could really hurt you. As Chris said, your long term is becoming shorter term. And then when you're in the distribution phase, that's when you're already retired and we are spending from your money. Whether it's from your 401k or other accounts is immaterial. It's when you are consuming what you have amassed. So let's talk about the transitional phase. How we can adjust for this, because as Chris pointed out, yes, your long term has become short term. What we have to do for those people and what you have to do if you're doing this yourself or get your advisor to do for you if you're using an advisor is to create the long term again. You have to get your portfolio as if you were 30 again or 40, not 50 or 60. How do you do that? Think ships. That's what I tell people. Think like a ship. Think like a ship builder instead. Years ago, they made wooden one-hulled ships. Why? It's really all the technology allowed them to do is make a wooden one-hulled ship. And what would happen if that one-hulled ship went aground or sprung a leak? It would sink. There was no protection in that ship. But eventually, shipbuilders had the technology and had the wherewithal to say, wait a minute, if we put two hulls on, maybe separate those hulls by 3 or 4 feet, if the outer hull runs aground and springs a hole, well, gee, there's another hull there to offer protection. So I won't lose my precious cargo, the ship. It won't sink. And then shipbuilders made tripled hulls and quadruple hulls. I'm not a shipbuilder, so I have no idea if they have quintuplet hulls. I have no idea. We could Google it and find out. But you see what shipbuilders do, people? They create hulls, and the more hulls, the more protection to that ship there is. What you have to do in the transitional phase, you're not panicking over this market, and instead you're buying gleefully, is to start putting hulls in your portfolio. What is the precious cargo you need to save? Your life, your retirement, your finances. So what you do is what we call the bucketing strategy. As you get into your 50s, start determining, when am I going to retire? Gee, I'd like to retire in 8 years, 9 years, 10 years. How much money are you going to need for the first few years of retirement? And you should start moving that money right now into one pool of very safe. Let's say you need $20,000 a year the first few years of retirement. So you might take $60,000, 3 years of cash that you would need, and start moving it into a very safe investment. And that can be a variety of things, bank CD, stable value holdings, anything. I don't want to get into the types of investments, but hull one, bucket one, is safety for the first few years of money you need. Then you start looking at your portfolio and saying, okay, well, I'm also going to need that money to last me for the rest of my life, but I also need to take risk. I need to grow but protect. So you create what is called bucket two. We call that the principal protected bucket. And you look for certain investments inside those buckets that can never drop in value. If they move, they only move up. Yet they yield more than the cash in the ultra safe in bucket one. We use bank CDs for clients on that. We can use fixed annuities for clients on that. That's just a type of holding pool that yields a little bit more but adds some more safety. Now you look at hull three or bucket three. That's your investments. But if you have a bucket one and bucket two or a hull one and a hull two that combined have enough money to cover your spending for 8 to 12 years, we have just created a short-term pool into a long-term pool. So now we have investment bucket three. This is money even if the market was to begin falling and you got laid off into your mid-50s, you still don't need to sell this investment account because you have positioned hull one and hull two. So now you have what we call risk capacity. Your risk tolerance may be such where you still don't like to see things fall, but now you know, wow, I have protections. I have cash for the first few years. I have safety, principal protected products for the next 8 years. So combined, I got 10 to 12 years of protection. I can take risk with this money. Because if everything goes as planned, I'm not going to retire for 8 years, and I have 10 years of protection. You now have an 18-year hold. I got news for you. You're no longer 55. You're in your early 30s, relatively speaking, if you see where I'm going with this. So now you can take your investment pool and feel comfortable. Hey, wow, every month the market's going down. I'm buying lower and lower and lower. This is great. It's nothing to panic over. I'm buying more because I have put hulls in. I'm protecting my ship. And then the fourth hull is what we call longevity protection. That is where you can start designing products and investments that last and generate income for the rest of your life. That's often Social Security, pension, income annuity, deferred annuities, inside retirement accounts. Now, you may have heard of QLACs, qualified lifetime annuity contracts that the government now allows. So there's ways you can also position a fourth hull that even if hull one or bucket one, hull two or bucket two, hull three or bucket three all got pierced, there's nothing left. They're gone. Bucket four is your longevity bucket and continues to pay income for as long as you and your spouse are alive. And Chris and I consider that to be secure income. Hence the name of our whole process, the Secure Retirement Income Process. And the idea is that remaining hull can never, ever be breached. It's built not out of titanium. It's built out of that kryptonite stuff. What's that Superman super strong stuff? Kryptonite? Mm-hmm. No, kryptonite hurts him.
It does.
It does.
But that, I guess, would make it strong.
Strong. Yeah, even Superman
hurt,
can't get through
Superman.
It. Right. So that hull is impenetrable because it's backed by lifetime paying assets. It's no longer an asset. It's an income stream. So we help people understand that that's how income works. But can you get the picture, people, if you are in your 50s and early 60s, if you had already put these buckets in place, these hulls in place, you would be looking at this investment drop right now a lot differently. You would be excited to be filling up your tank at $1.60 and not insisting on paying $5. Don't fall victim to framing. Look at things, but put the protections in. That's why people panic, Chris. And then, of course, if you are retired, one of the first things you have to do is get out from having this one big accumulation portfolio and put these hulls in place immediately. So you can look at bucket three, and if you do it right for retirees, the only difference between a pre-retiree and a retiree on their bucket three, for retiree, we usually reserve 30 to 40%. In safe money. So when the market does drop, we can take it and buy low because they're no longer saving. People in the transitional phase are still investing. People retired aren't. So we don't want to sell something that's down 10% to buy something that's down 30%. So we tell them we're going to invest 80% or 70% of your money. We're leaving 30% in reserves for when the fall comes. That's how you manage retirement portfolios, people, and that's why you should not be panicking with what's going on.
So this is the Retirement and IRA show for January 30th, 2016. We've come to the end of our show once again. Thank you very much for joining us. If you have any questions at all, please get a hold of us at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. We will be back with you next week with a brand new show.
Like what you just heard? Missed some of today's show? Listen again on iTunes or the Retirement and IRA Show.com.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.